Turn to Proverbs 1 and verse 16. We're still in this section of Proverbs chapter 1 where Solomon is warning his son about these wicked people who would try to entice him to come join with them and to rob and kill people and to share everything commonly between them, share the spoil. It says there in verse 16, "For their feet run to evil and make haste to shed blood." Now, if you remember back in verse 11, I talked about how these men here that are described in this section of Proverbs 1 are reprobates, and we know that from this verse in Proverbs 1:16, because this is quoted in Romans 3:15, which we did go to before, and I'll take you there again briefly, and then we're also going to go down a little bit and look at another verse there in Romans 3 a little bit later. In Romans 3:15, Paul here is quoting from this verse, and there's another one very similar to it, both of which are he could be quoting from here. In verse 13, Romans 3:13, it says, "Their throat is an open sepulcher. With their tongues they have used deceit. The poison of the ass is under their lips." I wanted verse 15. "Their feet are swift to shed blood." And he's talking about here Jews and Gentiles all under sin. So he's talking about man by nature in his wicked state. His feet are swift to shed blood, just like this says. "Their feet run to evil and make haste to shed blood." So if you look then in verse 11 of Romans 3, we find out another characteristic of these wicked people. And this is going to shed a little bit of light on why Solomon tells his son to interact or not interact with these men in a particular way. In Romans 3:11, speaking of these same wicked men, he says, "There is none that understandeth, there is none that seeketh after God." So in that these men have no understanding by nature, then it would be vain to try to reason with them to get them to repent of their evil ways by appealing to their understanding, which they don't have. And then, so this makes perfect sense then when we look at verse 15, which was what we looked at last week, where he says, "My son, walk not thou in the way with them, refrain thy foot from their path," Proverbs 1:15. So he doesn't say, "My son, try to talk them out of it, try to be a good influence with them, you know, be friendly with them for a while and see if you can't let your goodness rub off on them." He didn't say that. He just said, stay away from them, steer clear of them, because these men have no understanding and they are not going to be admonished. And this is just a good principle that we should remember, to never walk with wicked people with hopes of convincing them to change, right? Now, if you have sinners who are repentant and they've shown signs that the Lord has changed their heart or something, and maybe they're still in their sins, but they are interested to learn or something, that's a different story. Because Jesus hung out with the publicans and the harlots, but he didn't hang out with unrepentant publicans and harlots, right? And people will use this excuse to go, "Oh, that's why it's okay to go to the bar and hang out with the worldly people there. Maybe I'll convert them." No, Jesus didn't go to the bar to drink with people. He didn't go to the whorehouse. He hung out with repentant sinners. There's a big difference there.
He didn't go searching for them. They came searching for him.
Exactly. Exactly. So when a sinner comes across your path and they are showing some type of contrition in their heart, some evidence of that the Lord's changed them and they're looking for answers, yeah, by all means, talk to them, help them out. But don't think that we're going to just go buddy up with wicked people and change their nature or something. And certainly don't think that your children are going to do that to other bad kids out there either, because that's not going to happen. Now, if you look in Psalm 1 and verse 1, Psalm 1:1, "Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful." So we don't want to be walking, standing, or sitting with sinners, unrepentant sinners, that is. Look in Proverbs 22:24-25. Who we make our friends and who we spend our time with has consequences. It will end up having an impact on us. Could be for good, could be for evil. In this case, when you find people like Solomon's talking about here, steer clear. Proverbs 22:24-25. Make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man thou shalt not go. And here's the reason. Lest thou learn his ways and get a snare to thy soul. Notice what he didn't say there. You know, make friendship with an angry man and go with a furious man so that he can learn your ways, right? And then save his soul. That's not what it says. It says stay away from that guy because it's going to be a snare to your soul. You are going to end up being harmed and he's going to rub off on you and not the other way around. I've said it before, but you don't try to clean up a mud puddle by taking a shower and then bathing in it and hopefully your cleanness will rub off on it or something. That doesn't work. And especially when we're dealing with, I mean, there's sinners and then there's sinners. When we're talking about people that are conspiring to murder and kill people, to steal their stuff, that's a different class of sinner. And so to try to change the mind of somebody like that is not going to work because these people have a heart of stone and only the sovereign grace of God could change that heart. And it, I mean, it takes a legitimate operation, a heart operation from God to turn like a Saul of Tarsus into Apostle Paul, right? Or a King Manasseh, turn his heart into something quite different. We are not going to do that. Only God can do something like that. And if we try to, we are going to end up destroying ourselves. Proverbs 13 and verse 20. He that walketh with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed. And I'd say as your children are, when they're young, but especially as they get towards adolescence, it'd be really important to try to instill this principle in them, that a companion of fools will be destroyed. Because I think about my childhood and how I was corrupted, and I not that I was some perfect angel, but if I wouldn't have hung out with the kids that I hung out with, my childhood or my adolescence would have been a lot different, I'm sure, because I wasn't raised that way, and I would have been a lot better off. Those guys had a very bad impact on me, and then through learning their ways, I'm sure I had a bad impact on a lot of other people. That's how it's you know, it's a slippery slope there. It cascades. So I think that's something very important to instill in your children. Now let's look at this verse here from another angle. Let's read it again. Proverbs 1:16. I want to draw your attention here to a couple of words in the verse. For their feet run to evil and make haste to shed blood. Notice that they're running and making haste to sin. And I say, oh, that saints were as motivated to do righteousness as sinners are to do evil. As you think about the motivation of sinners, especially some sinners, they are very diligent people, and they will go after whatever they want, and nothing is going to stop them, and they're going to work hard at it, and they're going to press forward, and they're going to get whatever they want. That guy that wants his neighbor's wife is going to keep on trying and trying, and he's going to think about ways that he can seduce her, and lay awake at night doing it. Sadly, I know of a, used to be, an ordained minister that did that very thing. Took his best friend's wife and plotted and schemed for a long time and worked on her for a long time until he finally got her. Makes me wonder about the spiritual state of such a man that would do something like that. But they run to evil. They make haste to shed blood. They don't waste any time going after their sin. The Christian life, we often refer to it as a walk. I think sometimes we've seen a lot of this out there in what is called Christianity, and sometimes we probably, if we would be introspective, we'd see it in our own lives, that it's more of a crawl. The wicked run, we're supposed to be walking, and sometimes we're on our hands and knees crawling around if we're not sliding backwards. And that's the continual battle of being a Christian. And we all fight that one. It says there, the wicked, they don't sleep. I'm kind of jumping ahead here a little bit. But it says in Proverbs 4:16 that they sleep not except they've done mischief, and their sleep is taken away unless they cause some to fall. So these guys, they're not gonna be wasting their time having a nice restful repose until they have figured out a way to accomplish whatever their sin they want to do is. But God's children are too often busy sleeping instead of watching, right? Isn't that what the Lord told Peter in Mark 14 and verse 37? the wicked, they're running, they're making haste, and sometimes we end up being spiritual sluggards, and the wicked are laying awake, they're not getting any sleep, and we're just off in our blissful, you know, stupor, not even paying attention to what's going on in our lives. Mark 14 and verse 37. Jesus says, or it says there, and he cometh. This is speaking of Jesus whenever he had his three disciples with him there in the garden. He told them to watch and pray. Well, he went and prayed. It says, and he cometh and findeth them sleeping, and saith unto Peter, Simon, sleepest thou? Couldest thou not watch 1 hour? Now, chances are, if Peter was like we are, if there would have been a good football game on or something that would have piqued Peter's interest, he probably wouldn't have been sleeping for an hour. He could easily watch the football game for an hour or easily done whatever was his interest, right? But when it comes to something that is probably one of the most spiritual things we can do, and that's talking to God, we fall asleep. We've all done it, right? It's funny. It seems like sometimes the more spiritual a thing is, the harder it is to do it and to keep your mind focused. How hard is it to keep your mind focused when you're reading the Bible sometimes, when you're praying, and your mind's just wandering all over the place? That's just that's our condition. I'm not sure why the Lord set it up this way, but he has, that the children of this world are wiser in their generation than the children of light, Luke 16 and verse 8. Because when you think about it, how many major successful companies do you know that have been started by Bible-believing Christians? Not very many. I can think of Chick-fil-A,
Hobby Lobby.
I think Panera Bread is actually owned by a Christian people. I saw in a little plaque in the entryway of one of their stores one time, one of the restaurants. But not very many, though. The majority of the companies and corporations, the majority of the politicians, although they all profess to be Christians, right? But the majority of the movers and shakers in this world are not Bible-believing Christians, right? They are the men of this world, and that's what their propensity is. And I think a lot of times just the rest of us are probably just more concerned about going to church, taking care of our families, trying to raise our kids, read our Bibles, just live a Christian life. And we're not we don't have aspirations of greatness and trying to get rich and making that the main focus in our lives. That might have something to do with it. But anyway, Luke 16 and verse 8 says, and the Lord commended the unjust servant because he had done wisely, for the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. This is the guy that was, yeah.
You said about the most of the owners of businesses in this world being men of the world. The world teaches that you need to be great and instills it in people to try to do things like that. But if you're a Bible-believing Christian, you know that you don't need to stress out about being great. You need to be good.
That's right. That's right. And he that humbleth himself shall be exalted. God will take care of the greatness.
Being good is more important.
Yes, that's right. I just read a quote from Matthew Henry just today, and he said something about those that follow after honor. It's like honor is like a shadow. Those that follow after it, it keeps moving away from them, and those that try to move away from it, it follows them. So you think about that. If you try to attain unto honor, you're not going to do it, right? But if you are humble and try to, you don't want the attention, you don't want the promotion, then it comes to you. It follows you. I thought that was pretty good. These sinners that we're looking at here, like in Proverbs chapter 1, these guys are diligent, deep thinkers, and their studiousness sometimes would put Christians to shame. Look at Proverbs 24 and verse 2. You got to hand it to the people of this world. They're pretty impressive people. They can get things done. They attain to power and influence. There's a reason for that. Proverbs 24 and verse 2, for their heart studieth destruction, and their lips talk of mischief. There are people that do that. They study destruction. Some of these guys think about the people that plan these awfully destructive wars. And they know full well this isn't about national security or something. They're just doing it for whatever, money, power, whatever it is. But anyway, they study at destruction, and their lips talk of mischief. There's people out there like that, unfortunately. Look at Psalm 64, 5 through 6. Like you go to college and you study Marxism, that's studying destruction. That's how societies and countries and peoples are destroyed. Psalm 64, 5 through 6. It says, they encourage themselves in an evil matter. They commune of laying snares privily. It's just like the guys we're looking at in Proverbs 1. They say, who shall see them? They search out iniquities. They accomplish a diligent search. Both the inward thought of every one of them and the heart is deep. Deep thinkers searching it out diligently, studying it. They'd put us to shame. They study destruction a lot, probably more diligently than we study our Bibles. You think about that. So just as a sluggard should go to the ant and consider her ways and be wise, like we're told in Proverbs 6:6, so should the Christian take note of the ways of sinners and imitate their diligence, but not their devices. See, we can learn from them. We can look at the way they do things, and we can imitate diligence, but not, we don't imitate what their aim of their diligence is, but we can imitate how they go about working hard for something. Let's look at just a couple of verses where the Bible exhorts us to do what these guys do. Remember, they run to do, how do you say it there in Proverbs 1? They run to evil, make haste to shed blood. Well, we're told the same thing. We're told that we should be running a race. Hebrews 12 and verse 1. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. So set aside the evil, right, and then run the race that Christ would have us to run. So we talk about the Christian walk, but maybe we should call it the Christian run. But the Bible does say we ought so to walk, but we're supposed to run too. And we're supposed to stand. So, I mean, there's a time to stand fast, there's a time to walk, and there's a time to run. All of those things are incumbent upon us. We'll get 1 Corinthians 9:26. Paul was a guy who was a runner. He labored more abundantly than they all, he said. 1 Corinthians 9:26, he says, I therefore so run, not as uncertainly, so fight I, not as one that beateth the air. So he knew where he was going. He had that finish line in sight, not running as uncertainly, not just running somewhere, and not just swinging at the air, but fighting the good fight. And that's what he said in 2 Timothy, I've fought a good fight, I've finished my course, I've kept the faith. That's what we should be aspiring to. Give you one more. And then we'll move on to Proverbs 1:17. Look at Psalm 119 and verse 60. So learn from the wicked. They lay awake at night, planning and scheming. Well, we're supposed to be not sleeping but watching, right? They run to do evil. We should be running the race that's set before us, right? We should be doing how they do it, only with a different aim in mind. Psalm 119 and verse 60. I made haste. Isn't that what it said? They make haste to shed blood. I made haste and delayed not to keep thy commandments. Run that race, make haste to keep the commandments. That takes care of Proverbs 1:16. Proverbs 1:17. Talking about these wicked guys here that make haste to shed blood and run to evil. It says Proverbs 1 and verse 17, surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird. So Solomon is going back to what he was talking about here earlier in the chapter. If you look back in Proverbs 1:11, here's what he's referring to. He's referring to them laying in wait, lurking privily. If they say, come with us, let us lay wait for blood, let us lurk privily for the innocent without cause. And then he says, surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird. So they're laying wait, but they're doing it in a way that they don't realize that they're going to get caught at, basically. It would be an exercise in futility to spread a net in the presence of one's prey, right? So if you were going to set a net for a bird or an animal or something, you wouldn't do it when it was standing there. If a police officer is going to try to run radar and catch you, he's not going to sit out in the open. He's going to hide behind the bridge or whatever, right? He's going to lurk privily and try to get some revenue for the state out of you. Privily means in a privy manner, not openly or publicly, secretly, privately, stealthily, craftily. These guys lurk privily. They think that their net will not be perceived by their victims, nor even by God himself, because there's no fear of God before their eyes. That's what it says in Romans 3:18. And in that passage there in Romans 3:18 is the passage where we saw that their feet run to do evil, where we looked at that passage there in verse 15. So we're talking about these same type of unregenerate people here. They don't have fear of God before their eyes. So not only do they think that the net is not going to be seen by the victims, but they don't think that God's even going to see it. He's not going to notice either. And we have some verses for that that we're going to look at here. First one is in Psalm 10, verses 8 through 12. These people are foolish enough to think that God doesn't see what they're doing, and they figure that they'll get away with it. And it's true. Most crime goes unpunished. I think I'm 90% is in my mind of crimes that never get solved. So a lot of them do go, I don't know if it's 90, whatever it is, a lot of them go unsolved. And you can imagine it's hard to solve a crime, right? Because people typically do it whenever nobody's around. They do it at night, and it's pretty hard to catch somebody like that, right? So they figure since nobody saw it, God's not going to find out either, but they have another thought coming. Psalm 10, 8 through 12. Speaking of a wicked man, and here we're talking about these same types, because in verse 7, Psalm 10, 7, his mouth is full of cursing and deceit and fraud. Under his tongue is mischief and vanity. That should remind you of Romans 3, 14. Their mouth is full of cursing and bitterness, right? That's the verse that Paul's quoting there in Romans 3. Okay, so Psalm 10, 8, he sitteth in the lurking places of the villages, in the secret places doth he murder the innocent, like these guys in Proverbs 1. His eyes are privily set against the poor. He lieth in wait secretly as a lion in his den. He lieth in wait to catch the poor. He doth catch the poor when he draweth him into his net. All right, the net is spread in the sight of any bird. He croucheth and humbleth himself, that the poor may fall by his strong ones. He hath said in his heart, God hath forgotten. He hideth his face. He will never see it. Arise, O Lord, O God. Lift up thine hand, forget not the humble. So this guy doesn't think that even God's paying attention. God's not going to see what he's doing there, trying to catch the poor in his net. They surmise that they've got their tracks covered. They operate under a cloak of secrecy, and they'll be able to ensnare the guiltless and won't get caught. But what they fail to realize is that there is a, quote, bird, and you'll understand why I'm calling it that. There's a bird who watched them spread their net, and he will deliver them. Remember, surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird. Well, there's a bird in heaven. And I put that in quotes, of course, and I'm not being irreverent. I'll show you what I'm talking about. Psalm 91, 3 through 4. There's a God in heaven that sees all this stuff. Just like Solomon said, that curse not the king, no, not in thy thought, nor the rich in thy bedchamber, for a bird of the air shall carry the voice. Right? God sees things. He finds things out. Psalm 91, 3 through 4 says, surely he shall deliver thee from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence. The fowler is a guy that lays a net for a bird, to catch the bird, right? He shall cover thee. This is speaking of the Lord. He shall cover thee with his feathers, and under his wings thou shalt trust. His truth shall be thy shield and buckler. The Lord has wings and feathers here, figuratively speaking, like a bird would protect its young. And the Lord protects when somebody lays the snare to catch the bird, you know, the little bird, unawares. So the Lord's paying attention up in heaven. And he's going to judge these vile men by one of his signature judgments, and that is by using the very trap that they tried to catch other people with, and he'll catch them in their own trap. And this is the coolest part. Psalm 9, 15 through 16. I just love this one. And then I will give you a few biblical examples of how God did this very thing. And it's just great to see poetic justice happen. And we see some of it down here a little bit, but on Judgment Day, we're going to see it in its fullness. And all the people that got away with all the crimes and all the wickedness and all the evil, they are going to find out they have another thought coming. Psalm 9, 15 through 16 says, "The heathen are sunk down in the pit that they made. In the net which they hid is their foot taken." It's exactly what's going to happen in Proverbs 1. We're going to see that in the next verse. "The Lord is known by the judgment which he executeth. The wicked is snared in the work of his own hands." Haggaion Selah. The wicked is snared in the work of his own hands. And this is the judgment that the Lord is known by. This is like one of God's favorite ones. He could punish you 7 ways from Sunday, but he really loves to catch you in your own net. Right? That's the one that he likes the most. And that if I was God, or if I had that ability to punish people, I'd want to catch them in their own net too. There's just something about that. That's just the best way to punish somebody, is take what you were going to do to somebody else, you get the same thing. That's what God loves to do. "These plans may go unnoticed by the sheep, but not by the shepherd, because his eyes run to and fro throughout the whole earth." Look at 2 Chronicles 16 and verse 9. Yeah, we little sheep down here, all we see is the bad stuff happening and wonder how we're going to make it through this world. But the shepherd sees everything, and he knows exactly how he's going to bring us through it. 2 Chronicles 16, 9. "For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong in the behalf of them whose heart is perfect toward him." And the second part of that, "Herein thou hast done foolishly, therefore from henceforth thou shalt have wars." So it works both ways. This king did foolishly, and the Lord was not showing himself strong in behalf of him. But people that's heart are perfect, hearts are perfect, he does. The Lord is looking out, he's paying attention, and he's going to take care of people whose hearts are perfect before him. It says in Proverbs 15:3 that the eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the evil and the good. So indeed, surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird. Right? If the Lord's eyes are everywhere, seeing the good and the evil, it is an exercise in vanity to try to spread a net to catch the righteous. That phrase, "in vain," that adverbial phrase, it means to no effect or purpose, ineffectually, uselessly, or vainly. So when these guys in Proverbs 1 are setting traps and snares to try to catch the innocent and to kill them, to take their stuff, they are doing so to no effect or purpose, or ineffectually or uselessly, because God sees what's happening and he is going to right the wrongs. That takes care of Proverbs 1:17. Look at Proverbs 1:18. Proverbs 1 and verse 18. Talking about these wicked guys here that are laying wait, laying a snare and a trap for the righteous. But look what's going to happen to them. Proverbs 1:18. "And they lay wait for their own blood. They lurk privily for their own lives." Now that's kind of curious when you think about it, because clearly when Solomon's describing them in the beginning, he's not describing them in terms like this. If you just turn back a little bit in Proverbs 1, it seems like he switches who the victims are here, and he does. He says there in verse 11, "If they say, come with us, let us lay wait for blood, let us lurk privily for the innocent without cause, let us swallow them up alive as the grave and whole as those that go down into the pit." So they're going after the innocent. They're not going after themselves, obviously. But then he says in verse 18, "They lay wait for their own blood. They lurk privily for their own lives." Well, how so? How is it that they're ensnaring themselves? And it goes back to what we talked about in the previous verse. It's because there's a God in heaven that pleads the cause of the oppressed. And these lives that the monsters end up destroying are going to be their own. They're not going to destroy the lives they're trying to. God is going to turn the tables. Let's look at Proverbs 22:22-23. God's looking out for the little, poor, humble child of God who is in the crosshairs of the wicked. Proverbs 22:22-23. Rob not the poor because he is poor, neither oppress the afflicted in the gate, for the Lord will plead their cause and spoil the soul of those that spoiled them. The Lord is going to turn the tables, as I said. He's going to spoil their soul that tried to spoil the poor. He's going to do the same thing to them that they tried to do to the innocent. Look at Proverbs 23:10-11. Remove not the old landmark, and enter not into the fields of the fatherless. So you get a landmark marking out your property line, and he's telling people, you don't go when nobody's looking to move that landmark, so you extend your property into somebody else's, and you take the property of the poor. You don't do that. Four, here's the reason, verse 11, for their Redeemer is mighty. He shall plead their cause with thee. Now, if God's pleading their cause with you, you're not going to win that argument, right? God takes care of his own. So it's for this reason that we should not despair when we see evil men in high places oppressing the helpless. Always want to remember that God, the righteous judge, he beholds it and he won't suffer it to continue forever. He may allow it to go on for a while, but not forever, and he will render the wicked their due. Let's look at a couple of verses. Let me tell you what the verse is, first of all. Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 8. Ecclesiastes 5, 8. This is why they're ultimately laying wait for their own lives, for their own blood, because God's going to have something to... He's going to change around this scenario. Ecclesiastes 5:8, if thou seest the oppression of the poor and the violent perverting of judgment and justice in a province, marvel not at the matter, for he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they. Even if it's the top level of government, there be higher than they. Whether it's the Congress or the President or the King or the Governor or whoever it is, there be higher than they. The Lord is ultimately on the throne. Jesus Christ is the Prince of the kings of the world, right? He is the King of kings, Lord of lords. He's the Prince of all principalities. So he's higher than they are, and he can change things around if he wants to. Let's look at Psalm 37:35-40. Psalm 37:35-40. David said, Solomon's dad, Solomon learned this stuff from his dad, I'm sure, I've seen the wicked in great power, and spreading himself like a green bay tree, yet he passed away, and lo, he was not. Yea, I sought him, but he could not be found. Mark the perfect man, and behold the upright, for the end of that man is peace. But the transgressor shall be destroyed together. The end of the wicked shall be cut off. But the salvation of the righteous is of the Lord. He is their strength in the time of trouble. And the Lord shall help them and deliver them. He shall deliver them from the wicked and save them because they trust in him. That should be a comfort to all of us. Ultimately, the Lord's going to use their net to catch them, punish them with what they thought to do to the righteous. Yeah.
You know, back in the Old Testament, the Lord says, you know, Moses wrote there was good kings and bad kings and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, do you think there's been any good presidents or any that you know of in the last 100 years?
Good presidents. boy. I can't think of one in the last century, really. I'd say, I think George Washington was pretty good. With minor exceptions, he did use the military to quell the Risky Rebellion, and that wasn't really constitutional. He because you had to, you could only quell a rebellion with the military if the governor of the state asked you to, asked the federal government to come in with the military. So that wasn't really constitutional there, but that was very minor with what we have today. But Thomas Jefferson was a pretty good, he was a good president too. So, and then most of the other good ones you've probably haven't heard of before because I listened to a course on the 10 best and 10 worst presidents, and the good ones were ones that were very unknown. And I'm trying to remember, Pierce was one of them. And,
they didn't make the big waves.
No, they didn't. And they were generally the guys that didn't accomplish anything. They didn't get anything done. Well, the ones that didn't get anything done were probably just doing their job, executing the law of the land and not doing a bunch of stuff they weren't supposed to. But, and typically the good ones are the all the popular ones. Generally the war presidents. Wilson's supposed to be a great president. He got us into World War I. Truman's a great president. He's the one that dropped the A-bomb on, I know Truman's kind of loved around this state, but around this area. But FDR, you know, the great love president, and he's the one that made the Great Depression great. And so, like, the ones that are the best, Lincoln's the one that pretty much ripped up the Constitution and destroyed states' rights and that kind of thing. So, yeah, all the so-called good ones were the bad ones and vice versa. And, you know, when you look back through the history of Israel, like you're talking about, especially in Israel, Judah was a little better, but in Israel, it's mostly more bad than good kings. And it seems like it's been that way in U.S. history, too, more bad presidents than good ones.
So it's like that all over the world.
Pretty much. I mean, you can't think of too many world leaders that were really good people that had the best interest of the of their citizens and at heart, and they're usually in it for their own self-interest and war and conquest and power and whatever. And it says there that the Lord, he sets men over the kingdoms of the earth, and he sets the basest of men up as the leaders. So let's see here. Point number E, that's where we left off. So Solomon could warn his son with confidence that the net that these men had spread for the innocent would be for their own lives based on his own father David's experience. So David experienced this very thing, that the net that they set ended up being the one that caught themselves. So one place is in Psalm 35, 7 through 8. Psalm 35, 7 through 8. Says, for without cause have they hid for me their net in a pit, which without cause they have digged for my soul. Let destruction come upon that, or come upon him at unawares, and let his net that he hath hid catch himself into that very destruction, let him fall. There are so many verses in the Bible that teach this very principle that we're looking at here, that they are going to be caught in their own net. And the destruction is going to come upon him unawares, which means that they're not going to realize they're stepping into their own net. It's like the dummy that dug the pit for some other poor guy to fall in, and then he forgot where he put it, and he covered it over so well, and he's walking around, and he falls into it. I did that one time when we used to, out in the woods, we were probably keeping the property safe from criminals or something. We were little kids, and we dug a hole like 3 feet deep and then laid sticks across it and leaves. And so, well, I'm lucky my poor dad didn't walk through the woods, you know, get a broken leg or something. But anyway, yeah, we ended up falling into our own pit one time. But stuff that seems like a good idea when you're a kid just a lot of times isn't the best. But Psalm 57 and verse 6. At least we didn't put big, you know, railroad spikes or something in the bottom of it.
Oh, really?
No, we didn't, so thankfully, yeah.
You didn't sit out on the outer end of the branch and then cut it off?
No. Well, come on, give me a little more credit than that, Judy. My.
That wouldn't be a crap, though, for you, maybe.
Yeah. Psalm 57:6. Says, they have prepared a net for my steps, my soul is bowed down, they have digged a pit before me, into the midst whereof they are fallen themselves. Selah. You think about this in David's life, and I'm not sure Exactly. Well, this is when he fled from Saul in a cave. So Saul ended up falling in the pit that he dug, figuratively speaking. Saul went after David. Saul ended up dying an ignominious suicide. Absalom went after David and tried to take the throne from him, and Absalom ended up dying, being killed by Joab, by his long hair hanging him from a tree. So just one more reason why men shouldn't have long hair, end up like Absalom, get hung by it and get a dart through your liver or something. But anyway, yeah, those guys, they fell into their own pit. David had that experience, passed it along to Solomon. And then look at Psalm 7. We're going to see here, once again, we're going to see another verse with God's signature judgment in it. And generally, when you find anything in the Bible that's repeated time and time again, like these verses, I've shown you at least a half a dozen of them, and there's more. When you see this, that should really jump out at us and think, okay, this is really important to God because he's repeated this many, many times. This is how he does things. Psalm 7, 15 through 16. Says he made a pit and digged it, and has fallen into the ditch which he made. His mischief shall return upon his own head, and his violent dealing shall come down upon his own pate. Pate is your head or your skull. So that's right there. That's how the Lord does it. Now let me give you a few examples. So we've seen the principle stated numerous times that the wicked are going to fall into their own pit, get snared in their own net. But let me give you a couple of actual tangible examples here. The first one is Abimelech and the men of Shechem, that the Lord rendered their wickedness upon their own heads. Judges 9, 56 through 57. Judges 9, 56 through 57. Thus God rendered the wickedness of Abimelech, which he did unto his father in slaying his 70 brethren, and all the evil of the men of Shechem did God render unto their heads, and upon them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal. Jerubbaal is Gideon. So they killed Gideon's brethren, and then they ended up being killed. So the Lord turned the tables and ended up giving them the same punishment that they had thought to do to others. Of course, you probably all remember the story of Mordecai and Haman in the book of Esther, in Esther 7 and verse 10. You remember that story that Esther was the Mordecai's, or Mordecai, I'm not sure which is the proper pronunciation, but anyway, she was Mordecai's niece, and she ended up becoming the queen of the land because the king got rid of the queen because she wouldn't come in and do a little glamour show for his friends. So there's this guy named Haman, and Haman was kind of the second in command with the king, or he was one of the higher ups with the king anyway. And he was a proud man, liked to be bowed down and had reverence done to him, and everybody would do that whenever they went into the palace or wherever they were going, except for Mordecai. Mordecai was a Jew, and he was not going to bow down to a man. And this just ate Haman up. He just couldn't take it. He could get bowed down to 100 times a day, and just that one guy that wouldn't bow down to him, and it was just killing him. So he comes up with this idea that he's going to have Mordecai hung on these gallows, and he builds this great big tall gallows to hang Mordecai on. And then the king has trouble sleeping one night, and he calls for them to bring in the chronicles, not the biblical chronicles, but the chronicles of the kingdom there, the Medes and the Persians. And they are reading to him, and they read about how one time this guy Mordecai had saved the king's life. He found out about this plot to kill him, and he turned these guys in and saved his life. And the king says, well, what's been done to Mordecai? Has Mordecai ever been honored or, you know, thanked or, you know, anything for what he's done? And they said, no. So the king calls in Haman, and he says, what should I do to honor the man the king wants to honor? Well, of course, Haman, being a proud man, he thinks, who else could he be talking about? Obviously, he's talking about me. He's like, well, yeah, put him on a horse and put him in royal apparel and make a big to-do about it and you know, whatever. I don't remember exactly whatever he wanted to do. And he's like, oh, that's a good idea, Haman. go get Mordecai and do all that stuff you just said. And that's just, Haman's just so upset that he ends up going home and getting all in a huff. And then he goes back to talk to the queen. I forget how exactly that happened. And ends up like making it look like he was trying to do bad things to the queen as he was pleading for mercy. And the king got angry about that and said, go hang him on his own gallows. Anyway, Esther 7 and 10, we'll just cut to the chase here. It says, so they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified. So I think he made that thing 50 cubits high, which had been 75 feet high. Quite the miniature skyscraper there that he was going to hang Mordecai on, and he got hanged on it. And then, of course, you remember the story of Daniel and the Den of Lions. Those men, they knew they couldn't get to Daniel with any evil that he'd done, but they knew that Daniel was a faithful man, that he went and he prayed with his windows open every day toward Jerusalem. So they came up with this idea that said that the king would make a law that nobody could make any petition except to the king, to any god or man. And they did this to frame mischief by a law. They wanted to catch Daniel. Well, Daniel went and prayed just like he had before. And so they brought him before the king. The king felt bad about it. He didn't realize he'd been set up. And the deal was that if anybody did it, I think it was for 30 days, they would be thrown in a den of lions to be killed. So the king reluctantly sends Daniel to the den of lions. And the lions, God shut the lions' mouths, we read, and robbed them of their prey, as the song says. And they didn't do anything to Daniel. And Daniel came out, and the men that had orchestrated that whole thing, they got thrown to the lions, and they got eaten by the lions. They got the exact judgment that they thought to do to Daniel. Daniel chapter 6, verse 24. So this is the kind of thing that I'm talking about here. When the wicked are caught in their own net and they fall in their own pit, these are examples of such things. Daniel 6 and verse 24. And the king commanded, and they brought those men which had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives, and the lions had the mastery of them, and break all their bones in pieces, or ever they came at the bottom of the den. I mean, that would be a gruesome thing to think. I mean, just to, you read about it, and you just, I mean, if you don't really think about it, oh yeah, they get eaten by lions. But you just think about them being eaten by lions and their bones broken, and their kids and their family, their wives, and yeah, talk about God letting them fall into their own pit. They got exactly what they wanted to do to Daniel.
And people watched this. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And Christians had these things happen to them under the Roman Empire. They got thrown to the lions, and yeah, people are wicked.
They were play toys at the Colosseum, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I've been through that.
Oh, to the Colosseum. I thought you meant being eaten by a lion. I was going to say, you are tougher than I thought.
No,
yeah.
Because the actual wooden floor is actually caved in.
Oh.
Oh. And they kept all the slaves and stuff, and now all those one ways ran together to get them out of there and get them in back and forth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So you got to get, could you go up to the top where the seat? Oh, really? It's.
Yeah, yeah,
oh.
You can go up to the top seat, and you could also take a tour and go through the areas down below. But before they fell in, it had rotted for years and years.
Yeah.
But people didn't realize all the stuff was actually underneath the floor.
Huh.
Everybody thought that was just sand.
Yeah.
You look at movies and stuff because you don't think that they're actually underneath there.
Yeah. Was it like the size of a baseball field today? Like,
oh, it was huge. Well, probably like the size of almost like maybe the size of the cheese steak.
Really?
It was big.
Yeah. Wow. This can all be summed up in Job 5 and verse 13. And this verse is actually quoted by the Apostle Paul in the New Testament, showing us that the book of Job is scripture. Job 5 and verse 13. It says, he taketh the wise in their own craftiness, and the counsel of the froward is carried headlong. And Paul quotes that in 1 Corinthians 3:19, he taketh the wise in their own craftiness. So just like their craftiness to craft this law to catch Daniel took them in their own devices, right? Contrive this thing to hang Mordecai took him in his own devices. Ended up hanging him on his own gallows. That's pretty neat. And then Solomon enshrined these observations in his Proverbs, not only for his son, but for all of God's children throughout all the ages. And I'll just give you a few verses here, in two in Proverbs and one in Ecclesiastes, where Solomon tells us these, reiterates the same things that we've been learning here tonight. Proverbs 11, 5 through 6. It says, "The righteousness of the perfect shall direct his way, but the wicked shall fall by his own wickedness." Think Mordecai, Haman, Daniel, the men that set him up. Verse 6, "The righteousness of the upright shall deliver them." Daniel, Mordecai. "But transgressors shall be taken in their own naughtiness." Haman, the men that set up Daniel. That's how it works. Proverbs 26 and verse 27. "Whoso diggeth a pit shall fall therein, and he that rolleth a stone, it will return upon him." And let me give you one more. Ecclesiastes 10 and verse 8. "He that diggeth the pit shall fall into it, and whoso breaketh an hedge, a serpent shall bite him." So that takes care of Proverbs 1:18. Next time we'll look at Proverbs 1:19, and that'll be the last verse in this midsection of Proverbs 1. So Proverbs 1 is broken up basically into three sections. The first section where it talks about the purpose of the Proverbs, and then that second section there warning his son to stay away from the from evil men, and then the third section is wisdom crying out to men to repent, and when they don't, then wisdom ends up turning them over to their own devices, and we'll get into that here soon. But next time will be Proverbs 1:19.